You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to Sean Morley. Very interesting character, this one. Relatively new, and I'd say relatively, a couple of 3-4 hours under his belt, technically, I think. But very, very exciting to watch. He's got a real... He's got a real mission statement, and the thing he's after is pretty unusual. I will leave that there tantalisingly. This is a thinky one. I think if you enjoy the comedy of people like Simon Munnery and maybe... Who else came up in our conversation? Mark Watson, to a certain extent, but in a sort of an oblique way. I can bandy names around all afternoon, or I can simply introduce you to the Infinity Lad, Sean Morley.
Oh, we're recording.
Yeah, we're starting.
Oi, oi, oi.
Why don't we start with an intro? You are newer than many comics I've had on the show. I think you were doing the New Act comps in 2015?
Yes, I was. So I started doing comedy in university. There was a big festival that was put on in the union by the resident improv troupe. And they invited loads of sketch and improv troupes around from all different university societies. And it was like near Freshers Week for me. I was just entering university and I'd never really thought about comedy. But then I just went to loads of it because it was like sketch. And to me, I had no interest in stand-up comedy whatsoever. I don't think I'd seen any of it that had appealed to me. But I'd grown up a lot watching like... Monty Python and lots of different things Rick Mail did and Vic and Bob. And to me, having some people out in an arena doing weird things appealed to me. And I saw a lot of sketch very quickly over a weekend. Like, I saw almost like 3 separate projects, different Footlights people were doing. Whip Tank, who I haven't heard of in a long time, but they were quite... prevalent here a few years ago.
Yes, they did lots of... Was that Naz Osmanaloo was in Whip Tank and Kieran...
Boyd? Is that...
Let's go with Boyd. I think it is Kieran Boyd. Okay. And a third person who it shames me to admit I don't know the name.
Yeah, and there's originally a fourth person, and then, like many sketch groups, they whittle down over the years to smaller and smaller groups. But I was really fascinated by that, and I saw one group I really liked called the Animals of Butterbridge, who later on I'd meet again later and become good friends with. And they were doing this bizarre thing about, I think a ghost was haunting a date or something, and the whole auditorium was filled with props. And the thing that I really enjoyed about it was they were in our main auditorium at Sheffield University, 350-seater minimum, mass walkouts, loads of people despising it. And I got a real thrill from being like, loads of people hate this. And they're still doing it and they're having a great time. And I'm here having a great time as well. But something about my experience was heightened by the litany of people walking through the aisles.
What percentage of the audience do you suppose walked out?
I think it's the first time in my life I'm going to see like 100 walkouts of a show. And it was wonderful. And there were what remained was the hardcore of people who were going to see it through. And it wasn't one of those ones where, like, they wanted people to walk out. They were just doing something very, very specific and very stupid. And it wasn't for most people who were, like me, undergrads who don't know what they like. So, yeah, I started off in sketch, university sketch comedy. It's where I cut my teeth.
That reminds me, just the inverted commas with which you said cut my teeth, reminds me of an element of... One of the sort of peripheral elements of your output is your blurbs. You do very good blurbs.
Oh, thank you. I find blurbs really tough.
Well, they are... Yours are... I really enjoyed it. Is this your second hour or your third hour?
Technically, it's my fourth hour-like thing.
Okay.
Yeah. I like... So, in a way, 2015 is when I... Is, like, the canon start of when I became good at what I do. And then there's 2014
the
and before. Is just a primordial Sean Morley who exists for the sake of a complete record, but as far as I'm concerned, was just a different child who inhabited my body. So I was doing sketch comedy, university sketch comedy, and I think it went all right as far as a university sketch comedy troupe can go. It went all right considering. Half our numbers were made up with people who were doing me a favour by being in the troupe and acting out all the sketches and had no real ambitions within this field. And then eventually I turned to stand-up quite a lot out of just sheer practicality. Like, I don't have to travel with four other people. Just train tickets alone is a good advertisement for being a stand-up. But I was very bad, that's the problem. I was very bad at it.
What were you bad at?
I think in hindsight, a lot of what was holding me back was just a lot of, like, baggage of my own personality that I had to eventually let go of. It was only through doing sketch, because we did, our troupe, did a very, very short run at the Fringe in 2011, I think. Space UK, did a week. It was nice.
What was the troupe called?
Oh,
come on.
It was called Fuddlepuck. And it was only after we'd, like, printed stuff and registered a domain, someone was like, someone's going to think that's an intentional spoonerism. I thought, no one would think that, because if you do think that, you'd have to have a very low estimation of us that we think fucking a puddle is funny. But people did, yeah. And then I met Wit Tank, and they're like, oh, what was it? They said to me, I was flying near them, and one of them went, a fellow disciple of Dr. Spooner. I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. I think we were trying to make, like, an amalgamated word, like, around befuddlement and being puckish and silliness. And it really only occurred to us later that people would... reverse the nouns and make the word fuck, and that wasn't my vibe, and it was really uncomfortable.
What was the content of that show, and to what extent was that show kind of you as auteur getting other people to do your bidding, and to what extent was it a collaborative sort of process?
I think I started off kind of very control freaky and very auteur-y, and then I met someone else in my second year of university who had the same ambitions I did to, like, do comedy seriously. And then he signed up, and then we discovered that having two ambitious figureheads that really wanted to be the only figurehead actually was signed the death warrant for the troupe. And that was kind of it for me in sketch comedy, because I'd graduated by the time that was kind of going its own way. And it's kind of hard, like, asking around university lectures who wants to join, like, a ragtag performance group, you know, asking around your new part-time job. It's not the same vibe. Can't really ask, like, the people you work with if they want to do that.
And what is it, what is the, as an ambitious figurehead, what is it that you had an ambition to create at that stage?
I think that's where it all went wrong. I think I came with... I think when you first write sketches, and it's probably true for stand-up as well, but I remember feeling it most acutely with sketches because it was my first foray. writing your first show or writing your first set of drafts came really easily. Because I'd seen so much, it's almost like I had years of ingesting things and being like, oh, here would be my version on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment you want to go past that first show and go, cool, and now I've got like a small body of work and what's next for me? How do you improve upon... I think it's easy to sit and see things in the world and go, how do I improve upon that?
Yeah.
It's very hard to look at yourself and go, how do I improve upon that? How do I improve upon me? And I ended up going off in very... I think I've always had an impulse to go, well, why not just go completely off at left field, do something that might not work at all, but surely there'll be something to gain from the experience.
Okay.
Which I think was one of the reasons why we have creative differences within the group, because I had a real thing of going, here, I've written this, and they go, this doesn't make any sense. It's like incoherent. And I go, yeah, yeah. That's the USP of this material.
It occurs to me I haven't yet sort of set you up for, in terms of the listener,
right,
as to what it is you do.
Yeah.
And I often talk to people on the show when they have a longer or more significant body of work to look back towards. So before we go any further, I feel I need to sort of publicly state, I'll tell you why I've got Sean on the show.
Oh, yeah.
The show I saw of yours at the Mac Festival this year, which was called, it's this show, isn't it, that you're doing at the moment,
yeah,
The Fringe. And it's called, I Apologise, or is it the...
I Apologise for My Recent Behaviour.
I loved the shit out of that show.
Thank you.
I really felt like I was watching someone who had a clear goal, a clear sense of their own means to achieve that goal, and the specifically there's a section in it where you do your mood. I don't know the name of the bit. I've since seen it on YouTube as Sean Morley's world famous
mood spectrum routine.
The mood spectrum routine, which has sort of under 1,000 views, which I have no idea if you don't say that. I just loved that routine, and I loved what you did with us, which felt like a sort of a very flexible and very free improvisational game that you were sort of leading us on. I didn't feel you were working to a script. I may be wrong about that. But you were... You're starting this show, or you did then, sitting in the audience applauding and getting everyone to applaud with you and really playing from the off with that dynamic of, what is this? What are we watching? What are we participating in?
Yeah.
And I found it so entertaining and so a really thrilling experience. I've since listened to one of your a clip online of you at a BBC New Talent competition, I think, in which, again, it's clear you can... I felt I could see the bones of the same sort of thing that you do, which is to... I suppose the nearest thing for people... listening unfamiliar with it, I mean, who could just, if they could be bothered, just pause it and listen to it. The only other thing that I've seen remotely like is kind of Mark Watson, when he was doing competitions years ago, had a sort of a describing what's going on in the room feel to it. Or, you know, we know Stuart Lee likes to sort of talk about the sort of point of the audience, but it's very distinct from both of those things. So can you just give us a bit, we'll go back into the kind of the genesis of
it. Yeah, sure.
But what do you think it is that you do?
Oh, feel free to edit out a long pause while I think about how to answer that. What do I do? I think I'm trying to do two things at once at the moment that is... feels almost contradictory, but I'm going to keep approaching it where I'm trying to have what feels like a very fluid, reactive conversation with the audience, where I do things or like set them a scene or a proposition and they respond to it, which in turn informs my resulting behaviour. That's what I want to do on one hand. And on the other hand, I want to be able to take people on... give people an experience that still feels like it has like an arc or a flow from beginning to end that still feels like it's not just a succession of random things happening. And so those don't sound like they go together, because if the audience can respond in any way I want and then I'm suddenly thrown off onto this off course, how would I ever have a show that at the end can wrap itself up? And I think this year I have managed to do that. I think by the end of the show I'm doing, everything I do is in response to the audience, but I always get the same ending and it feels like it completes the experience we've had.
Good. Why?
Why do I want to do that?
Why do you want to do that? Or what don't you want to do? That might be an easier way to kind of get... What sorts of things don't you want to do?
I don't want to jump ahead of the gun, and we'll come back to this later. A lot of what I do got informed by when I stumbled upon something that became the Glang Show. And that will make more sense later, dear listener. But what I got into my head was... You know when you're at a comedy show and someone drops a glass or something happens and a comedian just responds to it?
Yeah.
There's a frisson of energy to that that sometimes is not present within the scripted material.
Yes.
You see someone who's sort of behind the veil of a monologue step forward and be in the room for a moment. And I always love those moments. And I think what I'm drawn to a lot is like real, genuine error. When I'm seeing a performance and I see the cracks in it, and I see that all it would take is for just something to go wrong or a ceiling tile to fall off, and this is all so fragile. I found that so funny. And I became really interested in trying to make my performances more about that. And when you're like really early on, it's really easy to do that because you're playing in these really stupid rooms. You're playing in a lot of rooms that aren't really very suitable. And having people come out and just try and like pretend that they're in a theatre or a black box studio seems so silly to me, where I'm like, we're in a back room of a pub and there's this here and this doesn't work. And I just found all that so funny, and what a missed opportunity not to talk about how like stupid it is we're all sat in this stupid room. And I think when you drill down, I think that I've got a belief that comedy needs to make... Live comedy should make a virtue of the fact that it's live. I think that people have moved away from it because everyone's got... I think a lot of canny people have a long-term multimedia strategy in mind. And so they're thinking, well, this monologue has to be able to work at someone through a screen.
Mm-hmm.
So why would I be referencing this small detail of this stage or this thing here? It has to be something that could be transplanted maybe one day into radio. But then I think, well, then we're fighting the good fight against screens in a way. We should make a virtue of the fact that me and you, we're in the same space. The things that can happen here are bespoke for this night to night. It doesn't have to be that you just do a whole improv show. But that's why, like, comedy courses teach those little tricks to fake that that's what you're doing.
Mm.
Oh, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Ireland. Oh, I've got a story about Ireland. It makes you think, oh, this is connection to the room.
Mm.
But, you know, people that do that often, they just wait until they find someone from Ireland. They're really like, they're on tracks from go. And I love when something feels like it's not on tracks, that it could go anywhere, and the show could be destroyed in a moment.
So this is Sean. You can tell how excited I am to be talking to this fantastic and very engaging brain. It's really exciting to see someone and just know in the first 2 minutes of sitting in their show, ooh, a different thing. Not just different, but different to all the other different things that have gone before. And you can very quickly start grouping stuff like Sean's into that kind of weird comedy where you're sort of outside of the parameters of what the thing is, if you see what I mean. It's very difficult to explain it. As Sean himself says, he's after a fluid conversation with the audience and a structured experience, and he's drawn to error and fragility. Now, that's not normally the mission statement of most comics out there, but it's definitely something that creates a really beautiful... I almost want to use the word filigree, but I don't know what that is. It's definitely a really interesting and palpable and invigorating theatrical experience, which is not to say that there aren't lots of laughs. I really enjoyed his show. I apologise for my recent behaviour. And he's definitely one of those people. I can't wait to see what he does next. And every new thing he comes out with, I'm there. So more from Sean Morley in just a second. Couple of little bits and bobs to do. We've launched, from the sublime to the ridiculous, we've launched a Secret Santa. This was inspired by, if you remember, the great T-shirt cock-up of 2017, where the extra Thanks Man T-shirts, there were about 30 or 40 orders that, because of my inability to use Excel, all went to the wrong people. And when I carefully spent a week unpicking that and got people to send their T-shirts on to the correct person, lots of people took it upon themselves, lots of lovely ComCom fans, took it upon themselves to include a little gift to pass on the way, because it was nearly Christmas. So now we're doing that, but without the mountains of admin for me. If you go to the link that's in the show notes of this episode, I'll be tweeting it and putting it in the Facebook ComCom group as well, then you can find, you click on the link and it takes you to a site called elfster.com, which is completely set up in order to structure this sort of thing. So you simply sign up, you put your real postal address and your real email address so that you can receive the emails, and so that that postal address can then be randomly matched up with someone else who will send you a gift, and you send a gift to a third party, and it all looks after itself in a way that I don't have to and don't risk incurring any sort of awful GDPR situation. So click on the link in the show notes, sign up for that. I believe you need to sign up by, where is it? The last day to RSVP is December the 7th. I think if a few people are a bit later than that, if there's enough people, it matches them up with them. So all the Johnny-come-latelys and Jenny-come-latelys can sort themselves out. It's a lot of fun. It says on it, there's a couple of things to note. It's not immediately obvious on the landing page. There's a little yellow word that says more. If you've got to press that to get the further instructions. So I'm just going to say them to you now. You have to set a cash limit on this. So I've set a £5 upper limit. But the idea is not to spend money, but to pass on a pre-loved piece of comedy ephemera that you already own. So something that you discovered, something that you... I mean, if you have an old bootleg CD of something incredible, or, you know, a bit of... like, you remember when Adam Buxton was on the podcast? He brought me that amazing video of, like, a DVD of Adam and Joe's early stuff. And I forget what it's called, Sex Wax or something. I don't remember. But... anything like that, anything special to you or that you think would surprise someone else. So it's not so much about passing on a pre-loved Peter Kay DVD that the recipient is likely to have encountered before, but the more special and unique to you, the more of an exciting discovery it was for you, the better. You can anonymise your name if you like. You can ignore the wish list function. I think that's a sort of that's the thing the website uses to use Amazon affiliate links. Ignore that and ignore the birthday. You don't need to put your birthday in. You just need to commit to doing it. And then I think the 7th we pull the draw, and then a few days later you all get an email that says, OK, go for it, post your thing. Ignore the bit where it says in person. No one turn up in person. That's a hard and fast rule. Do not turn up in person. Just post the thing along. And if you're an international person, you can tick that box that says I'm willing to ship internationally, and then it will match up all of the people who are willing to ship internationally. So if someone's in Iceland and someone's in Canada, then they can swap and be paying a similar amount of postage. I think it'll be really fun. And more importantly, there's almost nothing for me to do. Yes! Now that's Christmas. So there's that. Now, a couple of other things to mention. The tour is still on sale. Go to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out where I'm going to be in the south and southwest of England in spring of next year. That's just the first section of that tour. There's about 10 dates in there, and I think I'm going to do another maybe 15 or 20 in autumn around the rest of the country. But if you're in the south or the southwest, not even the southeast, nope, just the south, the southwest, and maybe one kind of almost in the middle of Britain, then you can get your tickets for those. comedianscomedian.com/tour. The show's called End Of. I'm fiercely proud of it, and I'm really enjoying doing little bits and bobs of it in clubs at the moment. Let's chat about that in the postamble. I'm in quite a fun place, despite the phenomenal tiredness. That's everything, I think, for now. Changes are coming. Changes are coming. And when the change gets here, you'll know and you'll go, oh, yes, Goldsmith said change was a coming. I think I'll just wait for change to come. And then you can all go, oh, change has a come. And I'll go, yeah, it has. So on that mysterious note, I think that's all I need to say. Continue getting in touch with me at ComComPod on both Twitter and Instagram. Thank you. And for God, you can see my hapless experiments to try and understand how Instagram works. 10 years too late. And also email me info at comedianscomedian.com. As soon as I finish recording this bit, I'll remember the other bit I meant to say. But check out Sean Morley, search his stuff down online, but more importantly live. I think is far more important to see him live than it is to... Actually, having said that, there's some pretty weird stuff he's created online, so also look him up on YouTube. So that's that. Let's get back to Sean, and thank you once again to the Place Hotel in York Place in Edinburgh for allowing us some space to record. Sean and I were tucked into the extremely tiny double bedroom at the very top of the building in which Jack Doherty and I had recorded moments earlier, and I was quite relieved that Sean is slightly smaller than Jack.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I think one of the weapons in your arsenal is your ability to articulate what's going on in a very... articulate way. Do you see what I'm getting at? Like you have a real way with words, and they're very much at your fingertips when you're describing. I can't remember. There's a bit in the BBC thing where you describe them as the audience were sitting there in a combination of sweat. Do you remember this? I don't know if it was in line or it was improvised.
You're sweating, you're crying, and your sweat is merging with your tears, and you look squalid.
Yeah, that's it, squalid. Do you know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. No, was that line improvised, or was that something? And would you use that again, given it was such a kind of a big hit?
I actually didn't like it. It was a lot of what I do is you know, I play a character of someone who's got these ambitions, and the show's got away from them. But I really want that character to be quite sympathetic. So whenever I do, I think squalid's a bit too barbed, and actually I wish I toned that down. Squalid's a bit of a harsh way to describe everyone. But yeah, I remember a lot of people finding it really ballsy that I've come out to the BBC competition and I haven't really got a script, and I step out on the stage not really knowing what I'm going to do. I know I've got a few key points to hit, but it's really up to my own whims how they
and
get arranged.
You will be aware that that is not how most people do it. And did you consider there to be pressure on you to conform, or did you think, well, that's ridiculous, why doesn't everyone do it in a more honest, real way?
I think the fact that no one else does it adds a lot of value to someone who's going to do it. I think a lot of people tell me, like, I'm very scared of improvising. And I wouldn't even consider myself to be an improviser in the standard way. I think the improv techniques, like improv is a form. It's a form and it's a mode of performing, which I have done nothing to study. And when I've tried improv in the form that is, you know, classically called improv, I've struggled with it, because often you're creating scenes and you're talking to other characters, and that's a skill that I don't necessarily have or haven't really worked on.
Which aspect of talking to other characters have you... Do you mean character work generally? Like, you need to be a character in order to talk to them?
No, I mean, like, when I think of improv classically, I think of a troupe and they get a suggestion and they make a scene and it's an improvised sketch of some kind. And I think the skills that go into that are very different from whatever it is I'm doing. And I don't know how to distill what it is I do. I think I'm a bit lucky, because I come up with a I came up with an idea that I'm playing this very flawed character. They want something for there's some environmental reason they're not going to achieve that. And I rely very heavily on my ability to bring out sentences very quickly that sum up a very absurd situation in not a lot of time at all.
Yes, yes, I can see that. And do you... At what point did you discover that that is what you're doing at the moment? Like, was there a moment when you would, like, in a kind of a sort of nascent sort of finding your voice way? Finding your voice, in inverted commas, yeah. way. Did you feel like, is that a thing you discovered or is that a decision that you made?
I discovered Max. I definitely discovered it.
Talk to me about that process of discovery, given that what you discovered was something very unusual, I think, yeah. and very sort of fresh and invigorating and exciting to watch.
I discovered it in autumn 2014. Maybe winter, actually. Maybe it was winter. So I had just done a run at the Fringe, and I had a catastrophically bad time with the show I was doing. And a lot of it was that, partially it was that I was on the Free Fringe and I had bad luck with allocations and so on. And partially it's that I just didn't have the skills to deal with things that are arisen from, you know, sometimes if you've got venues on the Free Fringe where I think a robust enough comic can always deal with it, but a lesser one would struggle, and I definitely struggled. And I was trying to do something completely different. I was trying to do, like, a clever, smart, political comedy show, talking about a lot of political beliefs and trying to be, just a clever boy on a stage. I think one of the big things in my transformation was, like, really internalising that people don't need to know that I'm a smart boy. Like, really getting into my core, and it's helped me in my whole... Across the board, I graduated with a degree in philosophy, and I think that's its own environment that's toxic in its own way, and it takes a long time to really drill into yourself. People don't need to know that you're a smart guy. They don't need to know that.
Is that part of the toxicity of a philosophy degree? Mm. Is people showing off their smarts?
Yeah.
Smarts.
Well,
I've never used that phrase before. But showing off their intelligence.
Measuring their big brains. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And it's... I think it comes with that particular territory of the humanities as well. And so in 2014, I was doing that show and I was having a catastrophic time. And I'd also brought up on a whim something that was just for fun called The Glang Show. And I remember, like, this my show, to me, embodied in that moment everything that I wanted to do. I just wanted to, like... I think I wanted to be a Stuart Lear-like. I wanted to be someone that had clear, clever, defined opinions, could make, like, strong, tightly written routines around them, and would build on that, build on communicating something to people. And I was also doing this other show that wasn't about that at all, and I was finding that the second thing was fulfilling me completely, and I found such a joyous escape in The Glang Show. And then I went back home to Sheffield and I was kind of thinking about packing it in. I sort of reached the end of what I felt I was doing, and The Glang Show wasn't going to build a future for me. It just wasn't connecting, the stand-up. I was having a proper, like, crisis of faith. But it was winter and it was raining and it was dark, and I was going to fulfil the last few gig obligations I had. And it was some... It was one of those gigs where you know it's going to be a bad gig, but it's paid and you're going to go and you're going to make the best of your evening to the best of your abilities. But it was a new gig in a pub and they hadn't, like, properly turned the sports off, and it was just in the side of, like, this locals pub. And no one was being quiet for the comedy. People were going, just performing their sets, into the din. And I had this real moment of being like, I really don't want this to be my last gig, talking into the din. And I think I'd rather, like, crash and burn and die in flames and have that be my farewell story to comedy than just this pathetic, like, doing these silly little, I'm a young liberal boy with a humanities degree and I've come into Chesterfield to be ignored. And so all I had in my head was, I need to be louder than the din then. I need to be louder than the ambient noise in this room. What reason would I have to be loud? Because I need to shout if I'm going to be heard. I need their attention. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I need their attention first and foremost. And on my way up, someone, say with a venue, took a picture with me. Took a picture of me in a big camera. And without thinking, I went, I have not given you my permission to take that picture. My dad is the mayor of Chesterfield. And he could have... And I was trying to talk in, like, I'm a posh boy voice, so that people would be like, oh, his dad could be the mayor. Like, my dad is the mayor of Chesterfield, and I can get it all shut down. And, like, some people are like, who's this? What's this guy on about? And then I went behind the bar, and I didn't let anyone get served. Like, when people would come up, I'd just put my hand on the pump and be like, no, no one here is getting served until I receive an apology. And they loved it. They loved being shouted at. I think they just... It was just so stupid and so absurd what I was doing.
There was no suggestion that it was real?
I don't know.
Or but there was a tension that maybe it was real?
Yeah, I can't tell what they thought. A lot of people were laughing, but I think a lot of people might have been laughing at, like, look at this kid thinking he can tell us what to do. Which, so in their heads, like, I'm the real deal. But that's still funny. Yeah. And to some people, like, this is just a weird performance, but fair enough.
Yeah.
I think it didn't matter to people. And, like, by the end of the... I had 10 minutes, but by the end of it, like, I'd got this guy up who'd been saying racist things through the night just to sing I'm Sorry over and over again through the microphone. And I think maybe it's just if you show absolutely no hesitation and you don't blink in any way, people kind of get brought along whatever you want them to do. And so after that, I booked in some more gigs, and my only plan was, I'll try and shut down the night. And so I just got booked in for things, and I started doing my old material, and I'd look for something that I would claim was a problem that was so bad, the night needs to shut down. And I'd try and turn off the microphone, get the lights raised up, house lights, and I'd try and get as many people to leave the room as possible, saying this night's shut down. And then I did it at all three stands at their Red Roar.
Yeah.
I tried to shut down all three stands. And then one of the people on who was doing the tech that night then started to work at the McCunclith Comedy Festival. Mm-hmm. So that was an in. So me just, 2014, end of the year, I'm going to quit comedy. And then I have this, like, gleeful little thing about, I'm just telling people off and telling them to go home. And I was thinking, when's this? There's got to be a limit to how far I can go with that. I was picking people up and taking them out of the venue. Like, I was dragging people's chairs just out of the space, or just picking men up and placing them outside and coming back in. I just wanted to know where the limit was.
Yeah.
I haven't found... Like, I'd never found it. There was never a point where I thought, that's as far as you can go.
Okay.
The further I went, the more people were like, wow.
Okay.
And then 2015, I got onto the BBC New Comedy Awards, and I tried to shut it down. I can't remember what I came up with, but for some reason I thought something was wrong, we should all go home.
You, in that clip that's online,
yeah,
is that the one you're talking about, or was it like a kind of a semi-final that you tried to get it shut down?
There should be two on my YouTube.
Yeah.
There's my 2015 somewhere in there, and then 2016 is the more recent one.
Okay.
Yeah, 2015, it's not as good as the 2016, but I do try to shut it down, which I think is a funny thing to try and do on BBC Radio.
And you're speaking with such kind of fluency about, I think in one of them, I forget which, you're talking about, you come on and complain about where everyone's seated and then make the point that people in the future listening to this are inherently not here and, by the purposes of the format, blind.
Yeah,
or something along those lines.
Well, I realised, like, it requires such a different set of things to do when the audience is like over 120 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's such a different dynamic for what I try to do, because I can't have a conversation with an individual beyond that, because they won't be heard. They're not mic'd up, so they won't. The audience won't hear what they're saying. So I normally go to like treating people like sections that are behaving in different ways. And that's what I was doing that night, because like that was the Manchester Comedy Store, and it is kind of divided into thirds. But yeah, I did realise, unless they're putting a real strong pan in the edit, there's going to be lost on the actual majority of the audience tuning in.
Are you career-minded in any way, in a way that's different to the people that you were talking about before, comedians who have more of a desire to make sure that this stuff can work in these different formats?
I think I've had, like, in the last couple of years, I've suddenly realised, oh, like, I've actually received a modicum of success now. And, like, I'm not a big deal, but I'm suddenly not nothing at all.
Yeah.
And with that, I think I've suddenly felt a responsibility to myself to be like, oh, what do I do with it? Where do I go? And I think I'm starting to suspect I've got this aura of like, oh, I'm the new weird comedian that's doing weird stuff. And I've had some kind of experiences where I've done quite big clubs, tryout spots, and I've done well. Like, I haven't had a bad show or anything. But I still feel like I'm treated with some suspicion because of the manner in which I perform my comedy. I think I've gone out and I've had a good show, but I don't know, just because it seems so weird. But I don't think what I do is inaccessible. I think what I do really just cuts to the core of some quite common comedy concepts. I'm just a fallible person getting it wrong. I'm not trying to be obtuse or oblique, or I'm not trying to be purposefully underground, or I think there's a lot of I think there's a tendency, if you are told you're doing something weird, or that you self-define as someone that's doing something really weird, of being almost like a prickly, self-identified alternative comedian who makes it part of their mystique, that they're like, oh, this won't be for you, pal.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I've done like little working class pubs, and I've done like big middle class theatre shows now. And I don't think that it necessarily works in one more than the other, because there isn't anything. It's not supposed to be like a thinky performance, really. It's supposed to be kind of it's supposed to affect you viscerally, this guy flailing around not knowing how to do it. And like, I'm doing the show every day, and I apologize for my recent behavior, and I think the behind the scenes mechanisms of the show are quite clever, and there's a lot going on, there's a rich subtext to it, but the blow by blow of the show, no one should get left behind, because there's nothing in there that you can't understand.
If you think of the other very successful absurdists,
mm-hmm.
more recently than Monty Python, say Vic and Bob,
yeah.
and the Mighty Boosh, would be mm-hmm. the two most obvious examples, they have a quality to their absurdism, very different flavours of it, obviously, but there is a quality to it whereby it can take everyone with them. Almost like mm-hmm. like Harry Hill can perform yeah. to, like Milton Jones can have children in the audience. Like Vic and Bob, you sort of think there is a sort of a childlike or childish mm. quality to what they were doing on Shooting Stars or The Smell mm. of Reason Mortimer, whereby there was such a kind of a knowing, this is insanity mm-hmm. to the audience. Like, even though they existed within their own world,
yeah.
when they're, you know, the latest challenge is to whatever it is, fly in on wires and pick up crisps off a thing, you know. I wonder whether you are pitching as a kind of thinking man's, a thinking person's absurdism. Right. Not that I'm accusing you of pitching anything, which doesn't seem like a good fit with where you're coming from. But I wonder whether, because you are going for a sort of an if not intellectual, at least intelligent absurdism, like a visceral absurdism, an adult absurdism.
Adult absurdism.
Do you know what I mean?
Sounds pornographic.
It does.
I mean, is that because of the vocabulary I use that you're saying that it's intellectual?
Well, it's partly the vocabulary you use and partly the territory that you operate in, which you operate, is okay. The territory of sadness or loneliness or mood or
yeah, sure.
Not even sad, not negatively things, but in your mood, yeah. In your mood spectrum, the world famous mood spectrum routine. Without wanting to give anything away, you know, you are talking, they're adult, they're grown-up concepts about mood and kind of, they're somewhere on an emotional spectrum, you know, which isn't something that has a kind of immediately accessible feel to it. Which isn't to say, I'm not saying it wouldn't work in certain types of clubs, but I wonder about whether you can see it catching to a very wide audience.
I think the way I portray it changes. I think the concept is really simple. I'm getting people to chart their position on a happy to sad scale.
Yes.
And where I perform it, I basically just change the language around it. So if I'm performing at an arts festival, you know, I'll talk about ideation and anxiety and mental health, and I'll say those things in those terms. But if I think I'm talking to a broader audience, I'll just remove the terminological specificity of the words I choose to use. I'll just talk about it in terms of happy, sadness, mood. Happy, sadness, mood. We all understand happy, sadness, mood. It's just being happy or sad. I'm never trying to do anything that I think is... I'm never trying to do something which I think is beyond the understanding of any given person. But I play up this kind of... I play up my language a lot, depending on who I think the audience are.
In order to...
I think the more authority I can give myself, the more it's the better it is when I'm destroyed. It's better to destroy a tyrant than your friend.
Definite Sean Morley merch opportunity.
Yeah, baseball cap logo. Yeah, like, I want to play this confusing character who... Because to begin with, I think the character I played was, like, much less likeable and much more obviously frustrated. And now I think it's far more... it's more interesting territory for me for him to be actually very sympathetic and have been very reasonable. And you can see he's done his best. But despite all of that, it's all gone wrong. Because we've all seen a lot of characters that are, like, really blustering, and then you kind of are satisfied that Alan Partridge is satisfied when this actually quite not-kind man is given his comeuppance. But I think there's a lot more emotional grey area when you're like, Sean really did try his best and it all got away from him.
Absolutely. It's very rich.
Yeah.
It's very rich. It's making me smile now to recall that in the show as you describe it. That it is not a one note character.
Yeah,
it's like a seven note character. I mean, it feels rich, and I suppose that comes back to whether you think there is a mass market for it. Given it, I feel like stuff that is as clever as the stuff you do, stuff that is as rich as the stuff you do, doesn't necessarily lend itself to selling out a huge venue, which I'm not suggesting that you haven't said that's what you want, and I'm not saying no. You're putting
a lot of doubts in my mind about it. It's good to learn, yeah. Whereas I've come here to be given a real lesson.
No one's going to go for it. Wow. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm interested in, given your apparent rejection of the usual way of doing stand-up comedy, and now that we are in an era of stand-up comedy whereby people start with millionaire dollar signs in their eyes, you know. What would constitute success to you?
And I just want to make a point. Like, I'm not... The whole thing about, like, the way I perform being in reaction to things I've seen or that I think I personally don't enjoy as much about comedy, I'm not, like, a grumbling contrarian or anything. I'm not mudslinging. And also, You've raised some really good points, and actually it's given me a lot to think about what I'm doing. In my head, it was just, I want to remove any barriers to entry, you know? Anything where I think, oh, if someone's of this disposition or have this bit background, they won't be able to... They're not attuned to enjoy the show in some way, and I've tried to streamline that as much as possible while trying to keep it as... I want it to be a show where you could just watch it superficially and have a good time, but if you were to choose to sit and think about the show, you'd be like, oh, hello, there's actually quite a lot going on under the surface.
Sure. I think when I saw you at Mac,
yeah,
there were definitely people in that audience who were coming out having laughed for an hour and were coming out going, God, mad, isn't it?
Silly boy.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not suggesting that I have pretensions to have coming out going, yes, I understood the... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that I understood it on... Mm-hmm. a better level. I just felt like I was kind of tickled by different aspects of it. And I want to state as well that I'm coming at this angle of questioning largely from a place of envy that you don't feel constrained by things which I sometimes feel constrained by.
Right, you're projecting.
yeah, this whole fucking podcast is a project.
Do you know what? In the last year or so, and again, like, I'm not a big deal by any means, but you know, when you're starting doing comedy, you never think you'll leave the open mic circuit. You know, to leave that would be, wow. And I'm trying to give myself a bit of time to just, you know, I've listened to this podcast plenty, and I know how neurotic this vocation makes you. And I'm trying to make a point of just being happy and grateful for where I've got to. Because where I've got to is actually, you'd asked me a few years ago, I'd have just been satisfied to be here. And I'd love to attune myself just to be in a position where I can go, this, like, where I am quite now. I earn, like, a chunk of my income from comedy, and I live in quite a low rent north of England. I actually don't need to be as successful to live a full life. You just got to live in a deindustrialized area. And so I do consider myself, by my own metrics, to be successful. I'm doing what I want to do. And I've done a lot of things which... I haven't had to compromise on what I'm doing. I'm doing these very specific things that I'm surprised have gone as well as they have. And I'm having a very good fringe run. Like, everything's... I haven't really got much to complain about. On the flip side, I don't want to be complacent. I am pushing for things, and I've got other little projects in the works. And I'm now in the middle of... part of living in the north of England, and this was sort of a long-term plan. Was to sort of hide away, do loads of research and development, make something very unique, and then just start appearing in London. And I think it's an advantage you can have living where I was living as opposed to living in London, because in London, everyone's remembering you when you were bad, when you were just starting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just watching the slow progress of someone going up. And promoters remember you from like a few years ago when you weren't as good, and that can hinder you.
Mm-hmm.
But to just start appearing in London and people be like, who's taught you to do that? Where's that come from? Tell me now why you're doing that. and there is kind of like, I think there is like lots of divides. I think if you go north of the Watford Gap, there's just this thing called mucking around. But if you start doing it too southern, people are like, oh, have you studied in Paris? Have you? How many thousands of pounds did you spent on that to muck around? And so that was sort of the plan, and is the plan, is that, like, now I'm here and I kind of want to get some important, scary people to stoop down and take a look at what I'm up to. What's this little boy up to here? He's being very silly. Haven't got much traction on that yet.
Okay.
But that's the plan.
How hard are you pushing? How strategically are you pushing?
Well, here's the negative. So I had this thing where I just wanted to work on something, and polish it up and appear. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't think that was going to happen. I was just turning over rubbish. And then suddenly I've got an act, and I think it's very good, it's very strong. I'm doing something very particular and original. And I'm going down south, and I'm learning about the industry. But I'm so woefully naive. I don't know anything about it. If you start up in London, through osmosis, you learn about how the cogs of these things work. And then I'm coming down and be like, I've had to ask in the last year, like, ask people, like, what does an agent do?
Yeah, sure, man.
What do they do? What is it? And how do I get one?
I started in London, and a lot of that stuff was not apparent to me.
Yeah.
I remember coming up in 2008 to Edinburgh doing a sketch show with Richard Sandlin called Kiosk of Champions. Mm-hmm. We thought it was hilarious, and it was pretty good. There were some very good bits. Richard's very talented, and we had a fun dynamic. And then nothing happened. No one was interested. No one answered I don't know if we made many phone calls or if we sent many emails. But I remember thinking at the time, oh, you can't just... Like, I thought you could just come up here and be yourself. Mm-hmm. You come up here. We are currently at the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
That you could appear and do your thing and people would start to notice. And then the more festivals I went to, I sort of went, oh, no, you've got to do it 1 year. Then you've got to do it the second year so people know you're serious.
Yeah.
Then you've really got to do the next 3, 4, 5 years so that they know that you're not just some wanker who just turned up. Do you know what I mean? And it really takes time to bed in at the thing you're doing. I'm still in that process myself. I'm doing my 8th hour of stand-up comedy, and I am by no means someone who everyone's like, oh, classic Goldsmith. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, I think one of the big, like, I think a real common naive assumption, because the loads of people I know fell for the same thing, of, you know, you rock up, you do something important, and you smash it, and you go home, you're like, just going to wait for the phone to ring.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you learn, no, capitalise on any success and send emails and just remind people that you exist. And just ask for things. Like, it took me years to learn to just contact people that I wanted to have some kind of professional relationship with and just say hello. That's all it took. And I'm in the midst of getting over my anxieties about doing that.
Yeah. You teach, do you not? Do you do workshops in the sort of thing that you do?
Yes, I do. And I was supposed to do more of them and I struggled. I was going to build like 4 or 5 dates around the country somewhere. But then I really struggled to get one in London. I didn't think there was a point if I couldn't do, like, London, where I know I'd be able to get a good one. I have run less than 5 so far, but they've always sold out. And the reason I did it was because for a long time, living in Sheffield, I've got, like, half a foot in, like, the arts world, like the traditional funded by things arts world. And so I had a residency at an art gallery for a while as a resident comedian, which was really good, actually. It was really, really
amazing.
Very fun. We ran something there once called Scab Hour, which was... it was like a Glang Show spin-off, where the idea was the first part of the show was a focus group, and someone in a suit would come out and ask people what they'd want from their ideal comedy show. And as they wrote, that was written down on a Word document that was projected onto the wall. And... things could only be removed from the document if they had occurred or had successfully been realised in the room, and no one was allowed to go home until the Word document was empty. and we did really fun stuff like that. And one thing they said was they encourage all their artists to do workshops of some kind, because they're an art gallery, so most people are doing visual arts.
Mm.
They're doing pottery and painting and photography and all that. And I felt really squeamish about doing a workshop because who am I, you know? Who am I to give anything instructive of? I definitely can't tell people how to be successful in comedy because I don't know. But I decided, well, what I'll do is there's one thing I uniquely can teach, and it's the specific style of thing I do. And I don't think there's a huge lot of us. And I started thinking, well, actually, maybe it would be good if there were more, because I really enjoy it, and I'd like there to be more people like trying to do this kind of thing. So I wrote a workshop for it, and then I advertised it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone asked me to go and do it in Liverpool, and then someone asked me to go and do it in Bristol. And I've just done it a few times now, and I've redone the whole thing, and I'd like to put out a workshop tour, I suppose.
And what do you call it? What's the... Not the workshop, but what's the skill that you're...
I've dubbed it scriptless stand-up.
Got it. That was it.
Yeah, I think I found it really hard to come up with a name that captured it. But I think one of the key elements is that you don't write with a script. And I think so much stand-up so many people I see at the fringe with all these notes, and whatever skill you are going to learn from here, you can't have all these notes because that's too limiting. You need to think about your stand-up in a way that's not set in stone like that.
Mm.
So I call it scriptless stand-up.
I part of me would like to ask you some of the sort of tenets and principles of it, but I don't want to undermine the workshop that you do. You know,
a lot of it is quite theory-based. I'm just trying to teach people to think about what they're doing in a different way. And it's not. And I think a lot of it is about reassuring people that it's not really as risky as it sounds like it is. Because you're not just going out into the unknown. In your head, there's a flowchart. If they respond to this, then do this. If they don't respond to that, then do this. And I don't think, like, I think people look at me as a risky comedian, but I really don't feel like one. I don't tend to have... The greatest trick of all is if you build failure into the act can't really go wrong. Because if it's someone that's supposed to mess up, the show going badly is the show going well. So there really isn't... you can't fail, because fail is success.
Thanks, man.
So that was Sean Morley. There's some extras with Sean. If you'd like to hear them, join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Just about 10 minutes worth, but we explore a little bit more about the Glang show. And we talk about some secret stuff that we thought would be better in the Insiders Club, because the Glang show is sort of a secretive, mysterious piece of work with which Sean is involved, and it just didn't seem right to sort of spaff it out there to all and sundry. So join the Insiders Club for a small recurring donation of however much you think the show is worth at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You get access to the extras with Sean, as well as the extras for all of the shows now that have extras. It's the only place to find them, as well as... the little Boutros is shouting at me in the background, but... he's gone quiet. We're all good. Yes, you can get bits and bobs of... It's a whole private podcast, all of the extras and all of the additional projects that we're doing. Comedy Critique. We're due another one of those any day now, so I'm going to get on that this week. And that's where we all group together and offer feedback to someone who is brave and foolhardy enough to send in a clip, an audio clip of their set, so that we can all sort of cluster around it and I curate everyone's feedback. Plus, if you become an insider, you get to join the workspace, which is a bit like being in an office with everyone, and we flick sort of office-type gossipy emails to each other all day. So you can join that and support the show and get hold of the extras all in one place. Now, I will re-mention the tour quickly. comedianscomedian.com/tour. Find out if I'm going to be near you doing my stand-up show, End Of. That is that. I'm going to post-amble at you in a second. I'm obviously extremely tired. I'm going to try and make it not too child-slash-tiredness related. I think I might have spent that particular bit of pocket money. But that is everything. Find Sean Morley at the internet. He's out there. Just look him up. I just don't... Have I mentioned this before? There's a site called Would You Like Me to Google That For You? And every time someone goes, where can we find more of this guy's stuff? I just feel like just put the name in Google and there's all the links. That's only what I'm going to do. Why don't you do it? So there's that. I am going to thank the Place Hotel on York Place once again. It's yorkplace-edinburgh.co.uk if you'd like to spend your hard-earned cash there in a luxury situation. Very, very nice hotel indeed. I mean, maybe I'll afford to stay there one day. Who knows? But yes, click on the Secret Santa link, which is in the show notes, the footnotes of this episode, or on the... Twitter place, the Twitter feed, that's called, at ComComPod, or indeed in the Facebook group, which, just a little shout out to everyone involved in the Facebook group, it's been going great recently. There's been some fantastic stuff in there. There's been some really interesting and respectful conversations about Louis C.K.'s return to stand-up. There's been some chat about whether Jerry Seinfeld can go fuck himself for charging £106 a ticket. I'm not saying he can. I'm saying there's been chat about whether or not he can. And what else is looking down here? There's some speculation about sort of a Taskmaster All-Stars series. Some reviews of Robin Ince's book, I'm a Joke and So Are You. which is very, very good. And also thanks to Chad, who he put this in the Facebook group. Hi, everyone. I'm Chad and I'm a comedian. I started doing comedy 3 years ago. I'm 44 now and I feel as though I left it too long to start. Is anyone else in the same boat out there? There's a load of comments on that. And I mean, you can get the tone of the place. This is one of the nicest corners of the internet. Literally no one is saying give up and go home. There's a lot of... and I tell you what, which is this... There's a little shout out for a Doug Anthony All-Stars documentary, which I can't wait to see. And where is this? There's a particular one that I'm trying to find. Tom says, thanks for the ad. As a white van driving, working class white male in my 30s, I'm obviously always judged as some kind of backward racist. But I got a job as a van man due to an epic social awkwardness, so I don't have to speak to people. And I listen to the same podcast the rest of you listen to. And as a van man who's surrounded by the kind of witless, sexist, racist morons every day at work, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be here. What a start. And he's been welcomed with very warm, open arms by you bunch of lovely nerds. And then more people saying, get John Finnemore on. Yes, I will. I'll get round to it. I'm booking at the moment, all right? Right, that'll do me. Get in touch if you like. Stick around for the post-amble. But for now, that concludes the show. Speak to you soon. Oh, you can see there the speed at which I'm talking there. Let's, Now, look, I said I wouldn't make it too kid-related. What was the thing I was going to talk to you about? It was to do with shows. It was to do with how much I'm enjoying not writing a new show. I'm just going to gigs and just doing a little mime of a Rolodex of the last 4 or 5 hours worth of stuff and going, oh, favourite bit there, let's do that bit, sew it all together, bang, it's all my faves and we're having a wonderful time. Rather than having that little voice in the back of my head going, go on, write new stuff. At the same time, I'm going completely crazy, not least with tiredness. So it's... I'm in a much more chipper mood than I was when I spoke to you last. But I have to... I'm just going to do a little kind of confessional here. I cried at a mum. Not just any mum, good friend of ours. And we were both dropping our children off at childcare and I had had a horrendous morning of trying to sort everything out so that my insomniac and breastfeeding wife can... those are not her only two qualities. but she'd... had a really tough night of it, and the morning's the only time she can sleep, and so I tried to do, right, Boutros, future girl, I'm going to totally take care of this. Nearly got them both out the house to get to Boutros' childcare, and it all just went tits up in that kind of house of cards, just everything sort of fell over. Suddenly there's urine all over there, there's the future girl is in a sort of bear Gruffalo-type suit that's gradually cooking her because Boutros won't get off my phone, and it was just like a sitcom-esque domino effect of like, that's gone wrong, I'm not coping. Suddenly her wails all seem to be going, you're not coping. And I then dropped the boy off and I came back. And on the way back, I bumped into a mum friend of ours who was kind of, it was one of those things where someone, you know, if someone says, how are you, that you're going to burst into tears. So I ran away. And then I thought, that's rude. So I stopped and waited until she came out and she said, how are you? And I burst into tears and she dealt with it really well. So for anyone else out there struggling, try and look after yourself and try and get some sleep. So much of it's sleep related. And if anything, let's choose a positive from this. I am reminded of how much better I am mental health wise than I used to be when I have horrible sleepless, you know, sleep deprivation induced crashes like that one and a couple of others recently, because then it puts me right back in, oh, this is depressed Stew. This is depressed, anxious Stew. And I hate being him because I don't have to be him anymore a lot of the time. So the positive is that isn't it nice to be reminded of how, what a change I've undergone. Is that positive enough? I hope so. I'm gonna try and notice things outside of my family for the next few of these. I keep saying that, but I think this first month of just not sleeping and what a sort of kind of COD army themed survival tips for dads book that someone gave me a few years ago. What it refers to as sympathetic detonation. That's when you throw a grenade in the grenade store and they all go off. The writer applied that to when one child starts crying just as the other one's got to sleep and they send each other off. We just had a night full of that last night, but it is starting to straighten out and it's starting to feel less mad. And I have to say, starting to get used to being tired.
Is that the best we can hope for? No, obviously, there's also a fabulous family and loving children and you know, great stuff like that. I'm great. Boutros has started. Anytime anyone says, how are you? He goes, I'm great. So that's nice. The point of me mentioning all this was that I had one of those little mini revelations where I thought, right, what happens is we're all familiar with the idea that people on social media show their best selves, which pop up in your feed over and over again. So it's like they're continually boasting about it, even if they only mention it once, it just comes up in your feed again and again. And obviously, if you know comedians, they are also boasting about it, myself included. So there's that effect. We're familiar with that effect. But I feel like I'm sort of doing a one of those that isn't social media based. I think perhaps all parents and maybe all people are just walking around pretending to cope. That's got a ring of truth to it, doesn't it? Because when I had my little cry at my mum friend, she was like, oh God, I was like this yesterday. And I was like, you weren't. She was like, I absolutely was. So, you know, we're all just pretending. Why don't we just all stop pretending? Can a few more of us just walk around in tears? Can we just walk around in an absolute fucking state with one shoe off in tears going, oh God, I'm not doing this. Because I think it would benefit the rest of us. Anyone not, I mean, how could we implement that? Like a certain number of days of the year that you're just not allowed to be, to have your shit together. You've got to be visibly in public, like the emperor. Isn't it the emperor had to spend one day a year dressed in rags and living as a beggar and seeing how the other half lived, how the other 99% lived? Maybe we should do some version of that whereby anyone, like the purge, but for people who cope. That's a good system. Purge coping. Cope purging? I don't know. What else can I offer you? Nothing. I can offer you nothing, and I can hear the family moving into the room above the cellar in which I'm currently talking to a cardboard box full of foam. So that'll do me for now. I promise to you that this week I will notice more things in the outside life that may be of relevance to you that aren't in my position. But I think purge coping ended up universal. All right, speak to you soon.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.